to ACT Radio, Animal Concerns of Texas. I'm Liz Walsh.
And I'm Tom Lee.
Here on ACT Radio, we talk about how we humans relate to other animals.
We talk about how we use them for food, clothing, and entertainment, and how there are humane alternatives to these practices.
And we also discuss why a plant-based diet is the healthiest for humans and the best thing one can do for the environment.
So if you're concerned about your health, if you're concerned about the way animals are treated, if you're concerned about the environment, stay with us for Animal Concerns of Texas. Coming up on today's show, we feature a conversation with Stephen Wells, Executive Director and CEO of the Animal Legal Defense Fund. Stephen has helped pioneer new strategies to protect the lives and advance the interests of animals through the legal system. And under his leadership, the Animal Legal Defense Fund has become renowned as the preeminent legal animal advocacy organization in the country. Our chat with Stephen is a little later in the show, but first some news. The Chinese regulatory agency that monitors drug and medical devices announced that imported ordinary cosmetics will need not be tested on animals beginning in May of 2021. This opens the door for beauty brands of all sizes to enter China, the world's second largest beauty market. The country's National Medical Products Administration regulates the decision and announced that ordinary cosmetics include those that don't make anti-aging and other active claims. The company must show safety assessments were done and other good manufacturing practice certifications to sell into the market. These certifications can come from governing bodies in their home countries. The news is a boon to a number of companies, including Estee Lauder, Procter & Gamble, and Unilever, who support animal testing bans. Many people are surprised to learn that animal testing is an ineffective method for scientific research, as 95% of drugs that pass animal tests fail on humans. Numerous companies are standing up against animal testing, and recently the USDA made a decision to eliminate some mammalian testing by 2025, but there's more to be done. It's time countries ban animal experimentation altogether.
The Center for Biological Diversity filed a petition seeking Endangered Species Act protection for imperiled Sacramento Mountains checker spot butterflies. The orange and black checkered butterflies are found only in high elevation meadows around the village of Cloudcroft in the Lincoln National Forest in southern New Mexico. The Sacramento Mountains checkered spot butterfly has been declining since the Forest Service began formal surveys back in 1999. By 2012, the butterfly occupied half the number of monitor sites it had formerly occupied, and it has continued to decline precipitously. Today, it is virtually undetected through most of its range, leading the Forest Service to conclude that it's likely the most endangered butterfly in the United States, with a non-trivial probability of imminent extinction. In response to a 1999 petition from the center, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service proposed to list the Sacramento Mountains checkered spot butterfly as endangered due to habitat loss, fragmentation, degradation, drought, wildfire, and overcollection. Unfortunately, the service withdrew that proposal in 2004 based on a voluntary conservation plan that lacked real teeth. It denied a subsequent listing petition in 2009, allowing threats to the butterfly to continue unabated. According to Tara Cornelis, an entomologist and senior scientist at the center, the sharp decline of the Sacramento Mountains checker spot butterfly is alarming. Clearly, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service's two-decade refusal to protect this pretty butterfly has contributed to its demise. We hope it's not too late to save it. The situation described in the service's 2001 listing proposal was so dire that the agency recommended endangered status and the designation of all suitable habitats, including unoccupied habitats and dispersal corridors, as critical habitat. Over the past 20 years, the Sacramento Mountains checker spot butterfly has continued to decline. No caterpillars and only a handful of adults have been observed in the past 3 years, despite expanded search efforts. The butterfly is still threatened by habitat loss, fragmentation, and degradation via livestock grazing, motorized recreation, invasive species, fire suppression, and climate change. The center's Cornelis says that by reversing their own conclusions and ignoring this butterfly's plight, the Fish and Wildlife Service has failed to protect this imperiled species. And she adds that the Endangered Species Act works, but only if species are protected in the first place. Too often, the fear of political backlash influences the agency's decisions and keeps it from doing its job to save species. To give the Sacramento Mountains checker spot butterfly a chance at survival, the Fish and Wildlife Service must list it as endangered under the Endangered Species Act and designate critical habitat immediately. For more information, go to biologicaldiversity.org.
As Texas and much of the southern United States faces unprecedented climate challenges, humans and animals alike face peril. But one large group of animals is particularly vulnerable: farmed animals. stuck on crowded factory farms as power sources die, and on barren, exposed ranges as biting winds blow, animals raised for food must brave the storm by no choice of their own. Industry standards allow animals raised for meat, dairy, and eggs to be kept in massive numbers, making evacuations impossible. Tornadoes, floods, snowstorms, fires, and other natural disasters are typically death sentences for these animals. In 2018, when Hurricane Florence struck the Carolinas, an estimated 3.4 million farmed animals drowned as a result of this very issue. Despite the fact that animals need shade and shelter to thrive, it's also common for pasture-raised cattle, sheep, and goats to live without either. Unexpected summer heat waves cause animals to suffer from heat stroke, while blizzards often mean animals freeze to death. When animals are raised and kept in these conditions, it's a given that deaths will occur when disaster strikes. Sadly, as long as farmed animals are considered commodities, the outcome of natural disasters will continue to be devastating for these vulnerable animals. But you can do your part to help stop this ongoing cycle of cruelty by adopting a plant-based diet today. Stick around. Up next on ACT Radio, we'll talk with Stephen Wells, Executive Director and CEO of the Animal Legal Defense Fund. Prior to joining ALDF in 1999, Steve served as the Executive Director of the Alaska Wildlife Alliance in Anchorage, where he became known for his work to protect Alaska's wildlife, particularly wolves and bears, and its unique wild places. He's committed himself to animal and environmental protection and has helped pioneer new strategies to advance animal protection under the law. The nonprofit he leads now has become renowned as the preeminent legal animal advocacy organization in the country, and a force to be reckoned with by animal abusers and industries that exploit animals, including the single largest source of animal abuse, factory farming. In addition to working with other animal protection organizations, the Animal Legal Defense Fund has successfully partnered with law schools, environmental protection, food safety, public health, and civil rights organizations, and has built strong relationships with companies that are creating humane products to replace those dependent on animal exploitation. Stephen's inspiring work to help the Animal Legal Defense Fund gain justice for animals through the legal system has been featured in the New York Times, the Washington Post, CNN, and more. Our conversation with Steve is up next on ACT Radio. Joining us now on Animal Concerns of Texas is Stephen Wells. Thanks for being with us, Steve.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Hey, Stephen, can we start out by having you tell our listeners how you got involved in veganism and animal advocacy?
Sure. It's, I think, like a lot of people, it's kind of a long and complicated story in some ways. Like a lot of folks, I'd always had an affinity for animals in terms of, you know, dogs and cats that we had as a kid. And maybe that's where it all started. But for me, I really like the outdoors. And it was always a big deal for our family to go camping and get outside and, you know, see wildlife and that sort of thing. And my family is mostly in Western Canada. So when we used to do family trips out to visit relatives in Western Canada, I got into more sort of serious outdoors activities, backpacking and kayaking and those sorts of things. And for me, one of the highlights of that was just being out in wilderness and knowing there were, you know, moose and bear and wolves and all that sort of thing. And for a kid who grew up in inner city Chicago, that was kind of a revelation. So in my later life, when I decided I didn't want to live the rest of my life in Chicago and managed to wind up in Alaska because of all I'd heard about what a wild and beautiful place it was, it was really the wildlife and wild animals that captured my imagination first and foremost. And that sort of led me to wanting to protect wildlife and their habitats and got me involved in volunteering to do environmental work, which ultimately led to a job working in for a wildlife protection organization up there. And it took me about another, you know, continuing to peel the onion, it took me about another 10 years before I became, well, it was less than that. It was, I guess I became vegan in 1996. And by then I was really thinking about the farmed animals themselves and started to think about their lives and the horror they were living in. And that's what really transitioned me from working in the environmental movement and really focused on wildlife to more of an animal rights perspective and starting to think about all animals more holistically and you know, the terrible lives that so many domestic animals were living, particularly farmed animals. You know, it's almost hard to envision. And, you know, you learn to, I know, just being aside from my work with the Animal Legal Defense Fund, you know, just being personally an animal advocate. And before I ever came to ALDF, just, you know, tabling and doing events and talking about veganism and those sorts of things, you know, you really learn you have to talk about the impacts on individual animals a lot of time to get people's attention. Because when, you know, you throw out a number like nearly 10 billion animals in the U.S. alone raised and slaughtered every year, it's almost mind-numbingly large. You know, it's hard to envision. And while it's a shocker, you know, when you break it down to what each of those individual 10 billion animals has to go through, you know, I think that's the thing that most reaches people's hearts and minds. I was just horrified by the effects on the environment and wildlife. And I think people, you know, still largely don't realize the enormous environmental impact and the enormous impact on species loss and biodiversity and so forth that animal agriculture brings.
It's interesting because there's a lot of, I think, things that we just take for granted. You know, you're growing up in terms of the advertising you see and not understanding that, you know, for instance, milk, you know, cows have to actually be pregnant in order to be able to, you know, or have be nursing a calf in order to be able to produce the milk.
You know, it's funny you mentioned, you know, school and thinking about things. It brought to mind a moment. I was when I moved to Alaska, I went back to school and I was taking classes at the University of Alaska in Anchorage, and I was in a chemistry class. And the teacher was talking about energy conversions and was, you know, showing how, you know, the sun coming down and plants are able to convert, you know, somewhere around 10% of the energy from the sun through photosynthesis and then create, you know, all of the life that they create, including, you know, carbohydrates and fats and sugars and all those sorts of things that are really the, you know, the basics of the food chain. And so, you know, there's this, they're only converting a small amount of the energy, the potential that hits the earth. Well, then when animals eat the plants, they lose, another 90%, you know, they're only converting the food value of about 10% of the plants that they eat into, you know, tissue and so forth. And then of course, when you eat an animal, there's another very similar, loss when you're eating the flesh of an animal. You're losing about 90% of the animal. So it's this exponential energy loss, which explains, you know, and it was I just remember seeing that equation plain as day on the board. And then there was, you know, bear in mind, this is Alaska. And there was one brave woman in class who got up and said, well, isn't that an argument for, you know, everyone being vegetarian? And there was sort of this, you know, this was probably about 1991 in Alaska, and there were not a lot of vegetarians in Alaska. But it sort of stopped the class, and the teacher, to his credit, said, well, actually, you know, yes, it would certainly, you know, limit our impact and something like that. And then on they moved. But it really stuck with me, you know, it kind of answered the question that a question that I didn't even know to ask of, you know, why was animal agriculture, why did it have these outsized impacts and so forth? And it really comes down to that. Again, you know, this is just a simple fact, doesn't include even the many ethical considerations, but in terms of, you know, how and why it's got such an outside impact, it's really right there. It's inescapable. Because there's just such waste involved. And then years later, I was taking a train from Chicago back to the Bay Area. And I can remember, and I grew up in Chicago, so I was used to the prairies, and, you know, drive outside Chicago and it is flat, and you wind up in fields of corn and or soybeans. And, you know, I didn't really think about it until as an adult, and I was taking this train ride, and you go across and you get into, you know, Western Illinois and then Iowa and these, you know, states that are growing most of the grain. And there were moments where from horizon to horizon out both sides of the train, all you could see was rows of soybeans. You know, these perfect green, same size little plants just stretching to the horizon on either side with the occasional rare, you know, tree sitting here or there. And that just reminded me of, you know, this is another impact that people don't think about is, you know, some upwards of 85% of the soybeans grown are grown to feed to animals. And because of that inefficiency, it takes so many more plants to feed the animals. And so this is another impact, because as you said, Liz, you know, no other animal is welcome. You know, you're looking at these green fields of soybeans, but really they're an absolute biological wasteland. You know, they don't want animals in there. They don't want insects even, or you know, different kinds of plants and so forth. So there's this monocrop of soybeans that just goes on and on and on. And, you know, corn, very similar, about 80% of the corn grown in the U.S. Is feed corn and is fed to animals that are raised for consumption. And so it's, you know, that's another impact, is all of that land was once, you know, prairie grassland and wildlife habitat that sustained, you know, hundreds of species of animals and plants and insects, and is now a, you know, a singular monocrop. And again, that's directly a result of animal agriculture.
Yeah, for sure. And that's certainly sort of one of the sad changes I think that we've seen over the years, which is, I guess, in counter to your experience too, with probably living in Alaska and then moving to California and then sort of seeing all the positive developments that have come about in the last, you know, 20 plus years that you've been involved in the animal protection movement. I'm curious as to, you know, sort of your, you know, on a lighter note, sort of the things that you've seen that have changed in the movement and have been better for animals over the last 20, 30 years since, you know, your perspective has been opened and your eyes have been opened about all these various issues that impact animals. Curious about some of the positive developments, I think, through the Animal Legal Defense Fund that maybe you have witnessed in this time.
Yeah, well, and there's a lot, you know, and that's what keeps us putting one foot in front of the other. You know, I went this is actually will be my 25th year of being a vegan personally. And, you know, in that time, I can tell you it's certainly a lot easier to be a vegan these days, and with all the incredible products that are coming out. So, you know, I have to say that give a shout out to the you know, the companies that are now making just amazing products for, you know, that can substitute for meat and dairy. And boy, you know, I can remember in 1996 there was no such thing, at least nothing reasonably edible that could replace cheese and so forth. And now, you know, you go into most grocery stores and you've got choices and, you know, different brands and textures and styles, and a lot of them are just outstanding. And that's, you know, that's really heartening, because, you know, as much as, you know, for me, the decision was pretty clear when I learned of the impact, I wanted to make this change. You know, it's not so simple for everyone. And there are a lot of things that come into play in people's food choices, you know, that have to do with things that, you know, are not just, you know, what the impacts are and so forth. So to make those transitions easier and to really appeal to people who are used to eating a certain way, I think is certainly one of the big changes that's happened and seems to be accelerating, you know, with the number of new products and the awareness, and now, you know, even fast food places offering, you know, vegan options and so forth. So I would count that as a major change, you know, since I've become a vegan. And I think there is a lot to be hopeful for there in more people making compassionate choices in what they eat. But then, yeah, I mean, so I've been with the Animal Legal Defense Fund for a little over 20 years now, be 21 years this November. And that's a long time to watch change. And I became very, very focused on, you know, as my sort of animal rights awareness grew personally, and I realized that I was moving more in that direction and wanted to contribute to that. The legal pathway really made a lot of sense to me because, you know, in context, when you talk about, you know, animal rights, it has a clear, there's a clear way to understand what that means in a legal context, you know, rights and so forth. And it's a little more, was a little murkier for me, even as I was an animal advocate, to kind of understand what I meant by animal rights. And when I learned, as I did, you know, after meeting Joyce Tischler, the founder of ALDF, who'd started this amazing organization, and we became friends and talking to her and reading books, you know, I saw one of the real key reasons for how we as a society that claims to, you know, care about animals and that we're, you know, if you look at how we treat pets and so forth, there's no doubt there's a lot of care for animals, but how industries like the factory farming industry can be born in that context, you know, how could such a monstrous industry with just unimaginably horrific impacts on animals, how could that come to be? And I really saw the property paradigm. I think really the fundamental problem to me is that animals in our legal system are still considered property, which essentially, you know, puts them more on a par with things like, you know, the chair I'm sitting on than with living sentient beings who are far more like us than they are different. And certainly in terms of their, you know, capacity for to feel and for emotion, both positive and negative, and, you know, to feel pain and all those sorts of things are really essentially identical to human beings. And so it makes no sense. But, you know, in this context where our laws say, and they're stuck in a, you know, a history that goes back a long way when we had fundamental misunderstandings about, you know, our own place in the universe and about the place of animals, you know, them being property means their value is really placed on their utility to people, as opposed to having any separate, you know, interests of their own. And of course, that's nonsense, you know, and everybody can recognize that that's nonsense. Anybody who's ever been around an animal or, you know, had a cat or a dog in their life or that sort of thing, you know, of course they have interests and personalities, and of course they feel pain and fear and you know, affection and all those wonderful things that you know, we've lived with animals, have experienced. But you can, when the law says that they're things and that their value really is in their utility, well, that's a firm foundation for horrific exploitation on the scale of things like factory farming, even puppy mills, you know, and which is essentially factory farming of dogs, you know, to feed the pet trade. And so that's why I became very enamored with ALDF's unique mission to protect the lives and advance the interests of animals through the legal system. And that's what continues to be unique about ALDF is our exclusive focus on the law. And you know, in the 20 years or so that I've been with ALDF, we've made great strides, you know, in the law that, and across the spectrum of the law, you know, we focus on criminal law, where we're starting to see fundamental changes in how animals are viewed and starting to be viewed as crime victims, for example, and starting to see, you know, prosecutors and law enforcement take animal crimes more seriously. Really, really deep fundamental changes in the way the law perceives animals. No, we've got a long way to go, no doubt. But, you know, with victory after victory and with a solid legal strategy, we can build on precedent through litigation. We can build on creating stronger laws through legislation. And then, of course, one of my beloved programs, because it's one that I started shortly after I came to ALDF, is our programs in the law schools, where we have a network of student chapters. So we're really, you know, getting the bright minds that are in our nation's law schools and who care deeply about animals to put their legal expertise and that, you know, hopefully their careers or part of their careers towards protecting animals. And so it's just building this momentum. You know, we're seeing, law students that I knew when they were in law school in the early 2000s who are now, you know, partners at law firms and working on the staff of congressional leaders and those sorts of things. So change is going to happen more quickly. You know, it's a curve. And all the success builds on success. Every time we establish a precedent in the law, that's available for not just ALDF, but for other advocates and groups to use and build on. And we see that happening. So I'm very excited. If you had told me 25 years ago when I went vegan that all these things would be happening and the products and I think the number of people eating plant-based would be what it was in 25 years, I would not have believed it. So when I think about how far we have to go, I remind myself of that fact and I realize 25 years is really not a lot of time, especially when I think change is exponential.
Yeah, and especially in the legal system too, where things can sometimes take a long time to take foot. But you know, I personally was in that same boat, and it was when I met you at a job fair that sort of, you know, my eyes were opened into fully understanding how the legal system really isn't consistent with our societal values about how we view animals. And so it was after that meeting and speaking to the value of information and the work that the Animal Legal Defense Fund does, and things like in the space of ag-gag and trying to make sure that the undercover investigations can be done and the public can learn about, you know, how things are happening inside the facilities in which food are produced. And I guess that's, you know, part of the where the hope stems is people are driven by their compassion. They don't support animal cruelty at their heart, and it's an issue that speaks to so many people. So it's just a matter of getting people the opportunity to hear the message in order to bring about some of this change.
Steve, can you tell our listeners where they can go to learn more?
Sure. So the website for the Animal Legal Defense Fund is aldf.org. So you can certainly go there and learn more about what we're working on and how we do our work. You can also sign up for our email newsletter and alerts and so forth, because we do often ask our supporters for help to get a law passed and raise their own voice. And of course, you can also find us on social media, wherever you go, from Instagram to Facebook to Twitter, you'll find us there. And absolutely encourage you to follow and learn more about the work that we do day to day.
We've been talking with Steve Wells, CEO and Executive Director of the Animal Legal Defense Fund. Thanks for being with us, Steve.
Thanks a lot for having me, Tom and Liz.
Thanks, Steve. If you like information about a vegetarian or vegan diet, you can go to the Veg Society of El Paso's website at vsep.org.
And if you'd like to listen to some of the past shows of ACT Radio, you can find them at ktep.org. Just click on the listen button. Until next time, I'm Tom Lee.
And I'm Liz Walsh for the Animals, the Earth, and a Healthier Humanity. Thanks for listening to Animal Concerns of Texas.